This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith in for Guy Raz, the podcast this week. Of course, the highlights from our shows this weekend. We had a story about Rotten Tomatoes and the politics of immigration.
Last week, we had 48 pickers. When the new law went into effect, we had 8.
And a personal favorite of mine, this is a great story about 300-pound NFL linemen and what they have to do to keep their weight up.
I made a point of drinking a gallon of milk a day by myself.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a lot of milk.
And since it's October, we got to put a little something scary in there. This is a trip to a haunted house. I tell you what, listen, do I have what it takes to be an employee at a haunted house?
Don't quit your day job.
Finally, the guy who gave us this.
When you poop in your dreams, you poop for real.
Delivers this.
You're the cream in my coffee. You're the salt in my stew.
Oh, that crazy Seth MacFarlane, TV Family Guy turned crooner. All that and more. Oh, so much more. On this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Up on Chandler Mountain in Alabama, it's harvest time. And every morning, Jamie Boatwright gets up early. By 6:30, he is out in the tomato fields, waiting.
Just seeing who all may show up to pick tomatoes that day.
It's not a bad time of year to work outside.
It's a beautiful sunny day.
Perfect temperature, 75 degrees.
Slight wind.
And Jamie Boatwright says the tomatoes are ready. A nice pink-orange glow. Big ones, the size of a softball.
Cherry tomatoes and also the Roma tomatoes.
But there is a problem.
We've got plenty of all of those different kinds of tomatoes and no pickers to pick them.
The fields here are quiet. Most of the Boatwright's usual workers have left Alabama, fled across the state line to Florida, too afraid to come out here and pick tomatoes. Late last week, a new immigration law went into effect in Alabama. The police can detain anyone they suspect of being an undocumented immigrant. Schools have to report the immigration status of their students. Life here on Chandler Mountain changed overnight.
Last week, we had 48 pickers. At the beginning of the week, when the new law went into effect, we had 8.
8?
And it varies from day to day. Sometimes we have 6, sometimes we have 7, sometimes 8. It just depends if, their level of anxiety is towards being able to come to work that day.
Level of anxiety. That's the crazy thing. Jamie Boatwright says they actually got special work permits for their undocumented pickers. But that didn't matter. The men got scared. Why take a chance getting picked up by the police? There are fields in Florida with better work and fewer hassles. We called up Victor Spazzini in Birmingham. He's originally from Paraguay, and now he's an organizer with the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. He says he saw the flight for the border firsthand.
The mass exodus that began really all at one time was on September 28th, on that Wednesday. And that night, I had a family that's close to mine, and they left that same night at midnight. With their children, and they gave their dogs away, and they were just weeping inconsolably as they drove away. They wanted to be out of the state before the sun rose, before the law was in effect.
We often speak about the immigration debate in terms of justice. Who has the right to be in this country? How far can you go to protect the borders? But there's an economic story here, too. Can businesses really function without undocumented workers? That's today's cover story. Whatever you think about the immigration policy in the United States, one thing is clear. There's the law, and then there's reality. Gordon Hansen studies the reality side of things at UC San Diego. He's an economist specializing in the impacts of immigration. Hansen says for decades, there has been an unwritten social contract.
In which we said, we're not going to make it easy for you to get in. You're going to have to work hard because there are going to be some barriers at the border. It's going to cost you some money. It's going to cost you some time. It's going to cost you some personal risk. And what that did, in effect, was to select out people who weren't serious, to select out people who, for whom the opportunity of being in the United States didn't matter that much.
This was great for the workers who actually made it across the border because once they were here, they weren't hassled all that much. But it was also good for businesses, creating this ideal workforce.
What we got out of that previous policy was a population of undocumented workers who were very focused on working. They had higher employment rates than U.S. native-born workers.
Sure, there were flaws, but Hansen says that from a business point of view, at least it was stable, it was predictable. You could plan a business based on the reality of immigration enforcement. The new tougher laws in Alabama and Arizona change all that.
And what we're getting now in immigration is just chaos. Piecemeal reform undertaken at the state level with different states doing different things, making it harder for employers to hire illegal immigrants, with the federal government engaging in an additional set of tough enforcement actions both at the border and at the work site, creating a jumble. Employers just don't know what to think about what's going to come down the pike next.
That's the problem on Chandler Mountain. Jamie Boatwright doesn't know how many tomatoes to plant because now he has no idea if there's going to be anyone around to pick them. This is a perfect example of what Republicans are always talking about, regulatory uncertainty. Government, they say, should stop interfering in business, making life unpredictable for companies. And yet Republicans passed this new law in Alabama. Why upset the tomato cart? I talked to the sponsor of the bill, Alabama State Senator Scott Beeson, about why the status quo needed to change.
Let's take the construction industry, for example. Two people are competing with each other. Both of them may be framers. One of them, because we have low unemployment at that time, says, I'm going to hire some illegal workers. I don't care what the federal law is. I'm going to hire these folks. And because he can pay them a little bit less and he's able to get more jobs because he has this ever-increasing illegal workforce, he begins to grow. Well, his competitor down the street says, you know, I really don't want to hire any illegals. I know it's against the law, but if I'm going to survive, I need to go down that same route. Well, he begins to do that. And as they undercut the prices for their subcontractors, you begin to see people no longer in the drywall business, more difficult to be in the painting business, bricklaying, and that sort of thing. So over the years, you end up with a big problem growing where more and more people hire more and more illegals, which is a continued magnet to draw more people into the state. And we've gotten to that point, and now we have to try to fix that problem. And there's a little bit of jolt that happens when you stop the car and turn around and go the other way.
Now, while you were considering this law, you must have heard from businesses around the state. They're complaining now. I assume they were complaining then. What were they saying to you?
A number of these people are coming out and basically saying, you know, now we're in a tight because we can no longer hire people and continue to break what was a federal law. Now it's a state law. I understand there's going to be a readjustment time, but it's like any problem you got to fix. There will be a certain amount of time you have to readjust, but things will be better in the long run. It is not going to be smooth and easy for every single person, especially if you've been out there basing your business, basing your livelihood on breaking the law and hiring an illegal workforce. I think that gets missed a lot also.
You seem to understand that this may be difficult in the short term. This is difficult
now
for some people.
I do, and I've always said that. I think what the unfortunate thing is that there were associations, groups, some members of the media who, since the end of May, 1st of June, when we passed our legislation, basically led business owners, farmers, et cetera, to believe that it would never stand up, it's never going to go into effect, and then they were caught off guard when it actually did go into effect over last weekend. We were telling them for weeks and weeks, no, we've done a good job, we've done our due diligence, and we're going to play on the ball field that we're allowed to, and I think it is unfortunate that they did not do the things in a third of a year, 4 months, to change the way they were doing business so they can get over these last couple of weeks of harvest.
Do you believe that American citizens, people who live in Alabama legally, do you believe that they're going to go out to the fields and pick the crops?
There's always the argument that Americans or Alabamians will not do these jobs, and I don't believe that. Americans and Alabamians have done these jobs historically. I think they will do these jobs again. There may have to be some differences in pay scale, but I think those are things and people will see these opportunities. The pay may have to be different, but Alabamians and Americans will do those jobs.
That's Alabama State Senator Scott Beeson. He spoke with me from the Gardendale Civic Center. Senator Beeson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert. Y'all have a good day.
You'll notice that Senator Beeson mentioned wages. Here's the theory. Without all those undocumented immigrants, the supply of labor dries up. Businesses will have to pay more to attract new workers, legal workers. Tomatoes will end up costing more, but Alabama's 10% employment rate goes down. But theory isn't working so well on Chandler Mountain. Jamie Boatwright is seeing more legal workers looking for work.
Since this law has went in effect, I've had a total of 11 people that were Americans to come and ask for work. A total of one of those actually came back the next day. I told him, yeah, be here at 8 o'clock in the morning. That person picked 4 boxes of tomatoes, walked out of the field and said, I'm done.
Wow.
And so these Mexicans, migrating workers, it has nothing to do with race. It has more to do with work ethic and culture. They do this year-round. They are in shape to do it. They're accustomed to doing it. The majority of your Americans, you know, they may go pick something out of the garden for 15 or 30 minutes, and it takes them till the next day to get over it.
They're often referred to as unskilled labor, but this is a sort of skill.
Oh, it's a specialized skill. By the time I taught someone that didn't grow up in this field how to pack a box of tomatoes, the tomatoes would already be gone. You know, there's a lot of people saying, well, pay more. Well, when you go to the grocery store, the way it stands right now, if Alabama has this law and we don't have the migrant workers, and then you got all of our competing states that we are competing with on a daily basis that do have those workers, their tomatoes are going to say on average be 99 cents a pound. My tomatoes are going to be $2.99 or $5.99 or $10.99 a pound. And the people as a consumer, when they walk in and they say, all right, I got Tennessee tomatoes here for 99 cents a pound, Alabama tomatoes here for $7.99 a pound, they look identical. Which one are they going to pick up?
He's stuck. Boatwright can't use a machine to pick his tomatoes. He can't find workers for the usual wage. But if he raises his wages, his tomatoes will be too expensive. Jamie's wife, Lana, says she fears how this will end.
This problem's not going to go away for the state of Alabama. The farmers may go away from the state of Alabama. Some of the industry may go away from the state of Alabama. But there's not a Band-Aid you can put on this to fix it quickly if this law is fully implemented.
If it's any consolation, there is something that usually ends this problem, an economic recovery. UC San Diego professor Gordon Hansen.
What we've seen after every U.S. recession in the past 30 years or so is once the demand for labor really starts to pick up, what happens is those same politicians who were preaching a tough line on immigration suddenly get softer.
Though Hansen says these new laws are so tough, it may be difficult to go back this time around if the law stays in effect. The U.S. Justice Department has asked a federal appeals court to look at the constitutionality of the Alabama law. Coming up, remembering a football renegade who changed the NFL. That's next on Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. Orlando Brown was found dead last month in his Baltimore apartment. He was only 40 years old. He'd been an offensive lineman for the Cleveland Browns and the Baltimore Ravens. His playing weight was 360 pounds. That's big, but it's not that much heavier than other linemen. The cause of death? Diabetes. Brown is one of five NFL linemen who have died in the last decade from weight-related ailments. In 1970, only one NFL player weighed 300 pounds. That, according to the Associated Press. In training camp last year, 532 guys were that heavy.
For some reason, offensive linemen think that they have to be this mythical 300 pounds, and if they're 298, that's not enough. 300 is the... And I have to debunk that myth.
That's James Harris. He's a nutritionist for the sports department at the University of Oregon, and he says he worries most about his linemen when they leave school. They still have these huge appetites, but they no longer have the structured workouts to burn the calories. Ben Lynch found that out the hard way. A knee injury ended his NFL career in 2003. By that point, Ben Lynch weighed 308 pounds, a far cry from where he started.
When I got to high school, I was 6'2", 180 pounds. And when I got interested in football, I obviously had to start putting some weight on. So it took a lot of eating and a lot of work in the weight room to put the weight on.
So every time you upped your game, as it were, you had to up your weight.
That's basically it. When I was in high school, I always thought I'll never weigh more than 270 pounds when I get to college. And then, heck, my sophomore year I weighed 270 pounds and realized that the game keeps changing and players keep getting larger and larger.
When you're in the NFL, were you trying to actively gain weight all the time? Is that what you thought of every day?
When I first got to the NFL, absolutely. I was thinking about how can I put weight on or maintain my weight.
So what was an average meal for you back then? What put on the weight? I'm sorry, this is going to make you hungry just talking about it, isn't it?
or sick to my stomach because I'm thinking about everything that I ate. So when I would eat just about anything. When I was in college, I made a point of drinking a gallon of milk a day by myself.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a lot of milk. And for breakfast, I'd have oatmeal or eggs. If I walked by a donut shop, I wouldn't be afraid to grab a donut or two. And during lunch, I would eat a minimum of 2 sandwiches and preferably 3. If I was down a few pounds, I might have a protein shake too, where you throw some protein powder in a blender with some milk and some ice cubes. And, you know, heck, there was an afternoon snack and then dinner, and then I'd have a peanut butter sandwich before I went to bed. So it really was pretty much a nonstop process of getting as many calories into my body as I could.
Now, you left the NFL because of an injury, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I had a left knee injury.
And all of a sudden, you're not playing football anymore. And how did that change your health and your view of your weight?
It was probably after my 4th or 5th knee surgery where I really knew I had to make a change. And the further I got into the knee surgeries, the more I realized and the more incentive I had to drop the weight. And once I dropped 15 or 20 pounds and felt the difference, it really gave me a lot of motivation to keep shedding the weight because it made such a difference on the impact with the bad knee that I was having the trouble with.
Did anybody warn you about this problem? You know, you were on a professional football team. There are probably plenty of guys around who had retired and were a little bit large. But did anyone say to you, hey, buddy, this weight gain needs to be temporary because when you're out of here, this could really hurt you?
Somebody may have told me. I really don't remember. But when you're a guy that's in your early, mid-20s and even late 20s and, heck, even early 30s, you don't really have a clear view of your mortality. And especially on the football field, if you look at the way that players throw their bodies around on the football field, I think if you have a firm grasp of your own mortality, then maybe you'll hesitate for the split second that can be the difference in making a great play on the football field versus getting beat on the football field. So I think when you're at that age and that competitive level, then your own mortality really doesn't come into play. And it's not until, you know, for me, it was my knee injury where I realized I wasn't indestructible anymore and that I was susceptible to injury and I was susceptible to the same health problems as everyone else. And it sounds strange, but it took the knee injury and it took my football career ending to realize that.
So how long did it take you to lose this, what was it, 60 pounds?
It's been a process, you know, and it's something that I've been at 240 for probably 6 or 7 months now. And shedding the 60 plus pounds, it took me a number of years to do it. And that was just getting the diet dialed in and the nutrition dialed in and figuring out what worked for me and my body type.
Are you not doing a gallon of milk anymore?
The gallon of milk disappeared with the 300 pounds.
That's Ben Lynch. He's a former NFL offensive lineman who advocates for the health and safety of athletes through the Sports Legacy Institute. Ben, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Robert.
It is October, which means the country's supply of fake cobwebs is getting dangerously low. The reason, of course, commercial haunted houses are open for business, filling the night with the screams of terrified teenage girls.
Ah, don't stop it! Ah! Sorry.
Oh, wait, that's actually me.
Oh, this is terrible. They said there would be no clowns.
Yes, they lied to you. Oh, my God, what is that, a microphone?
Yes, I brought a microphone to Blood Manor in New York City. And from the name, you would never guess that it's actually on the second floor of a downtown office building. Probably used to be a hedge fund. I stopped by this week before opening night because I've always wondered something. Who are these people who are willing to spend an entire month covered in fake blood chasing kids through the dark?
It's hard to explain. You either have it or you don't.
Jim Farrow has been running Blood Manor for 7 years. Here's the audition process. Farrow looks you in the eye and throws out a challenge.
You're a demented demon child, or you're a zombie stalker, or a serial killer, or whatever, and certain personality that has it.
Okay, I want you to be honest with me. I'm going to do a demented demon child.
Okay.
And you tell me if I got it. Ah!
Don't quit your day job.
No, really? I don't have it.
No. Listen, you have to be willing in front of these people. Like, oh, how are you tonight? You have to be willing to do that. You can't worry about being self-conscious.
Farrow gave me the run of the place before they opened the doors. And so I went up to the cramped and very noisy makeup room. There are two makeup artists spray painting the zombies green. Yeah, they actually use those little airbrushes. And at the next chair is KJ Hanna flicking blood splatters onto a cannibal.
There's a blood that I created. It's coagulated blood, which is a little thicker. You put a little coffee grains in it. Nicer smell. Actually, I think you liked it last time.
It woke me up.
But that one, it gives it a little more depth. Also, he's a cannibal, so he's gonna, it's the coagulated blood. It works a little better than the ooey, gooey blood, because we all know it doesn't really look like that after a little while.
I'd like to say that he looks scary, but nothing's that scary under fluorescent lights. The makeup room looks like just a bunch of out-of-work monsters waiting patiently in line to get their faces done. Well, monsters on one side and victims on the other. Amy Ast will spend her night bound and gagged. She's getting her bruises and burn marks painted on now. And her tortured character has quite the dramatic range.
Scream, cry, you know, ask for help. But mostly crying, yes.
How many hours will you have to scream and cry straight?
Wow, at least 6-7 hours probably.
Do you have vocal exercises you do, like scream exercises to warm up?
Yeah, I do a lot of water also. Okay. A lot of cough drops.
Amy is an aspiring model and actress. Hopefully some producer will notice victim number 3 in the fake torture room and give her a call. Mostly, though, being a success at Blood Manor means you can move up the ladder of evil. Look at Christopher Mitchell. He's an actor, played the werewolf last year. This year, he's headlining as a caged cannibal.
I don't like to act. I like to become. I like to imagine myself as if I was a cannibal. And
Wait. How do you imagine that you are a cannibal inside a cage in a state mental institution? How's that possible?
Well, I'm actually in a cage in a room, so that's the easy part.
Yeah.
Then all of this makeup, I get to see myself beforehand, so you know, you're pretty much looking at yourself, blood all over your body. I'm in this hospital gown.
He's about to demonstrate his best move when the boss comes in.
Listen up now.
Jim Farrow likes to pump the kids up before the doors open.
Everything needs to be primo. Makeup to the max, attitude off the chart. All right? God bless. Right. Good luck. All right, let's do it.
With that first scream, Blood Manor is officially open. And you know, it would be very easy for me to make fun of this haunted house, especially since I've seen them all without makeup. I know they're actors. I know what's coming. I mean, what's so scary about some bloody cannibal sneaking up behind you in the dark?
Ah! Oh, it gets me every single time.
In a few minutes, the golden age of Hollywood horror, or how Rosemary's Baby saved the scary movie from itself. That's next on All Things Considered from NPR News. When a loved one dies and is cremated, family members face a tough decision. What to do with the ashes? Some folks want the final resting place to be spectacular, spread in the Grand Canyon, launched into space, sprinkled in Times Square. And then there are those who just keep the remains in an urn at home.
The ashes get put on a mantle, stay there for a couple of years, and a couple of years later, they get put in the attic. A few years later, the house gets sold, and oh gosh, we forgot the ashes.
That's Thad Holmes. He's a conservation enforcement officer in Alabama who, along with his buddy Clem Parnell, came up with an unforgettable way to honor the dead. Their company is called Holy Smoke, and what they do is they take your loved one's ashes and they turn them into ammunition. Shotgun shells and bullets. The idea was born one night. Thad and Clem were working late, and they were talking about how they wanted to be buried. And Thad said he wanted to be cremated and sprinkled on a nearby lake.
That's when my partner said, well, not me. He said, I want my ashes. I want to be cremated, but I want my ashes placed into some good turkey load shotgun shells and somebody that he could trust to kill a turkey, use those turkey shells to kill one more turkey. He could rest in peace knowing that one more turkey, the last thing he saw was Clem screaming at him at 900 feet per second.
When you first heard that, did you think that's crazy, or did it have this little light bulb in your head? Like, I think other people might want that.
Well, actually, what I thought was, you know, he just expressed what I'd like to do with my ashes.
So, Thad, how does this work? How do people order this thing, and how do they get the ashes inside a bullet or a shell?
Well, I'm not going to tell you the specifics of it.
Oh, it's secret.
That's our trade secret.
Okay.
But the process begins after the funeral, after the cremation, after the mourning. Then you can send the ashes to us. We will take those ashes, put them into shotgun shells or rifle shells or pistol shells, and then ship them back to you.
This must be somewhat sensitive. I mean, it's a great idea and it's an interesting idea, but you are dealing with a very emotional topic and a very sensitive one, you know, handling people's loved ones' ashes. I mean, what do you do to make sure that this isn't cavalier? You're not just, you know, spilling ashes around the floor or you know, not treating it properly.
Well, that's our biggest concern. We want people to understand that each shipment of ash is handled with utmost care. So it's not a simple process. You're just going out and find somebody that can go, here, I'll throw them in there. It just doesn't work like that.
Now, I know your company's only been officially up and running for a couple months.
That's correct.
You charge $850 for a case of shells, and you've shipped out two orders. What did they have to say about the process? Did you hear back from any of them about whether they used the shells?
Without going into detail, I can't tell you who she was, but she was absolutely most appreciative. She thought it was the best thing in the world for her husband. He had been an avid outdoorsman, avid duck hunter. She wanted to have her husband's ashes put into some shotgun shells, a duck load, and a portion of them she sent to his friends that he hunted with so they could do a 21-gun salute for their fallen friend.
So, Thad, how do you want to be remembered when you die? Do you want to be put in these shells?
I am going to be put in these shells.
You've decided?
Absolutely.
And how do you want to have those fired?
My son is a dove hunter. He loves the outdoors, as I do. I want to have my ashes placed into shotgun shells with dove and quail load. If I have 250 shotgun shells, which is a case of shells or 10 boxes of shells, each year for 10 years, he could start off a dove season by grabbing one of my boxes with my ashes in them and go out to a dove hunt and say, Dad, this one's for you. So at least for 10 years, I'll be remembered by my son.
And of course, if he misses the bird, he can always blame you.
Well, I'll be dead and I won't care.
That was Thad Holmes. He's a conservation enforcement officer in Alabama, as well as one of the co-owners of Holy Smoke, the company that takes your loved one's ashes and turns them into ammo. Thanks, Thad.
Hey, thank you.
Walk down the produce aisle of your local grocery store. There are the button mushrooms, $4 a pound. The shiitakes, I don't know, about double that. If you live in a fancy neighborhood, maybe there are black truffles for $800 a pound. That is nothing. There's another fungus that can fetch as much as $50,000 a pound. But it's not for the flavor. Our producer, Lauren Silverman, went digging for some answers.
In English, it's called caterpillar fungus. But Asia knows it by the Tibetan term yartsagumba, which means summer grass, winter worm. And although it is a fungus, it's not the kind you might find popping up in your backyard, unless your backyard is the Himalayas.
This fungus cordyceps, they make their living by getting inside of their host insect and ultimately killing it and consuming it.
That's Britt Bunyard, a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's got a doctorate in fungus. So what he says this particular fungus does is take over the caterpillar's body and then erupt out of its head. And the result? A pinky-sized, mummified caterpillar with this kind of toothpick sticking out of the dirt. Britt Bunyard, who also created Fungi Magazine, says this is the most expensive one in the world.
The price doesn't compare to fungi. The price compares to things like gold and platinum and diamonds.
So why is it so expensive? Well, the fungus is also known as the Viagra of the Himalayas.
It is a faultless treasure of an ocean of good qualities.
The first mention of yartsagumba is from a 15th century Tibetan medical text.
In particular, it increases especially semen.
And the price? Well, it all depends on size.
Size matters. So the bigger the worm, the higher the price.
That's Daniel Winkler. He grew up mushroom hunting in Germany and now spends a lot of time in Tibet. Yartsagumba has been popular for centuries in China, but he says the price has jumped by a factor of 10 over the past decade. These days, if you're a businessman in China trying to impress at dinner,
cook up some nice goose or duck or something and stuff it with a load of caterpillar fungus and, you know, where the guest says or realizes, wow, I mean, this filling of the goose must be at least 500 or 1,000 bucks or something like that.
Because it is so valuable, yartsagumba has led to some violence. Last year in Nepal, 7 men went missing after a dispute over the fungus. 2 of them were found dead at the bottom of a ravine. That caught writer Eric Hansen's attention.
I said, what the heck is going on? What is this stuff?
Hansen is a freelance writer in New York. He's lived and traveled in Nepal, but never came across the prized fungus. So he tried to find it in New York City's Chinatown.
Sure enough, there it was. And in the first herbal apothecary I went into, there were 4 big glass jars of the stuff selling for between 500 and 1,300 bucks an ounce.
Hansen was so enthralled by this worm that he went back to Nepal.
As soon as they see that yartsagumba is sprouting in these high, high alpine fields, the whole village just empties out. And then everybody climbs up into the mountains and spends pretty much 6 weeks crawling around looking for the tips of yartsagumba.
A good harvest can triple an individual's income and completely transform communities, like the village of Nar.
The whole town used its yartsagumba profits to buy solar panels. So now you have this centuries-old stone hamlet, and on the corner of each building is a black solar panel about the size of a board game.
Here in the U.S., yartsagumba hasn't caught on. Mushroom hunter Daniel Winkler.
It's just too expensive. You really gotta believe it does something for your health.
Which is exactly what the fungus doctor, Britt Bunyard, is skeptical about.
There's no, to my knowledge, pharmaceutical companies in, say, the United States that have looked into this or currently are looking into this. There's just nothing that's been found out.
So I asked Eric Hansen, who tried this stuff in Nepal, if it did anything for him.
Nothing. My back pain didn't ease. My eyesight didn't sharpen. I didn't feel like springing out of my chair and taking a jog. My loins were not aflame and my libido did not rage.
But so long as yartsagumba is all the rage in China, there are still fungal fortunes to be made. Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
I know the show isn't over, but I do think it is time for a little dessert. And time to leave the studio for a few minutes. Destination Manhattan.
I'm here on the streets of the East Village, where there is no shortage of dessert options. In fact, I can look around here on this corner of 11th Street and 1st Avenue and see desserts as far as the eye can see. But we are not here to eat just any dessert. We are here to answer a question. Where did dessert come from? And I'm standing with
Michael Crandall.
Michael Crandall is a food historian and the author of the new book,
Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert.
I presented a challenge to Michael Crandall. Find me the oldest dessert in New York City. And I'm not talking about the rock-hard donuts on the coffee cart on the corner, but the kind of dessert they might have eaten 500, 1,000, 2,000 years ago. We started our quest at Vigneros, an Italian pastry shop, to see what they might have been eating in the Middle Ages.
Let's get some pinoli cookies. Let's also get some ladyfingers.
Okay, ladyfingers, where are those? Oh, I see them right there.
Then the biscotti, the almond ones.
We made two more stops for even older treats, and we brought our sugary haul back here to the studio. But before we eat, what exactly do we mean by the concept of dessert?
Well, the whole idea of dessert as something at the end of the meal is a pretty recent invention, but the idea of sweet snacks, something that is primarily sweet that you might have in the middle of a meal, or you might have outside of a meal, or you might have at the end of a meal, goes back, well, to the days when we started to sit down or perhaps recline, and to the days when sugar was something exceptional, something that only the very, very wealthy could afford. And as a result, they had the best stuff, and the best stuff was sweet.
All right, let's open up the box here. They've put it in a nice box tied with twine. Oh, and they've wrapped everything up individually. I'm feeling something hard here.
Oh, what you have there is biscotti. Now, biscotti were not invented in Seattle to go along with Starbucks, believe it or not.
These are these little hard cookie-like slices of bread, usually sweet with often nuts in them.
Yep. And those, well, originally, when you used to go sailing, right, everything would rot on the ship. You'd need it to last a long time. And so they made something called biscotto, which was bread that you bake, and then you cut it up and you bake it one more time. Eventually, what they started to do was they started to make cake, cut it up, and bake it one more time. Biscotto means literally twice baked. And that, well, it's a little hard to know how far back that goes because there's some reference to fine biscotti from about the 13th century, but we don't really know what that means. So the real recipes, the first real recipes for what you could identify as biscotti come from about 1550 or so. And there you've got more or less what you have in your hand, which is a mixture of flour, sugar, and nuts.
You can hear it crackle as I break it in half. Nice little almond biscotti. I feel like I've tasted the best that Italy had to offer in the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. But in order to go back farther than that, I have to go back to...
the Middle East.
To the Middle East. We went to a little cafe, and I'm going to let you say the name of this because it's Turkish.
And I'm going to mispronounce it horribly, but I'll give to take a stab at it. It is Gulu Olu. That's my best guess.
We had someone say it at the actual cafe.
Gulli olu.
Yeah,
gulli olu.
And I am opening the box here. This Turkish cafe we stopped at specializes in baklava, and we have at least five different kinds here.
This particular company, Gulli Olu, comes from a part of Turkey where they're really well known for their pistachios. And when you taste it, you'll notice that these pistachios have this complex, interesting flavor.
Oh, it's excellent. It's you can sort of, as your teeth move through all the little flaky layers, you can taste each and every one of them. It's great. So again, I have to wipe my fingers off here because as anyone knows who has tried baklava, they are sticky. Now, we are eating Turkish baklava, but I know this is controversial because baklava was spread by the Ottoman Empire around the Mediterranean, into Central Asia, really, and every country claims it as their own.
Well, one of the interesting things about doing this sort of archaeology, you know, the archaeology where you dig through layers of baklava instead of layers of dirt, is that you discover that civilizations have a half-life. And you can find that half-life, well, in the form of baklava, for example. So you can pretty well find the traces of an empire that ceased to exist, what, almost 100 years ago? By going to all the countries that have baklava. And of course, now everybody says it's their own. Greeks claim that baklava is their own. Georgians have baklava. You find baklava in Iran. All these places have baklava. And I'm not someone who's going to say who invented it because I don't want to get into trouble. But it's all connected through this one particular political unit that existed once upon a time.
I'm speaking with author Michael Crandall, who has written the new book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Well, now that we've moved through the layers of baklava, we need to dig deeper in this archaeological tour of desserts. We need to find the place whence sugar came from, because they didn't invent it in the Middle East, did they?
They certainly didn't. Where sugar, well, sugar wasn't invented, it was grown, right? But where they invented the idea of refining sugar was definitely India. Everyone pretty well agrees about that.
So India, we're talking, they were eating sugary desserts how long ago?
India, maybe 2,000, 2,500 years ago, something like that.
And you say in your book that this wasn't for everyday eating. This was almost a religious item at first.
This was food of the gods. This was food of the gods because to boil all that sugar down, to refine it, was outrageously expensive. And often what they did was they would combine it with various milk products. And as you can imagine, in India, milk goes bad, right? So they figured out all sorts of ways of preserving it. In Europe, the way they figured out to preserve cheese was to add salt. In India, it seems, they figured out that if they boiled down the milk with sugar, they would preserve it.
So we picked up this assortment of Indian treats. What do you think is most like what we would have been eating 2,000 years ago?
Probably the closest thing to that would be something called barfi.
Barfi, which one's that?
Barfi is this one. And now, is made in all sorts of ways. It's sort of like, well, you tell me what you think it tastes like.
Okay. It is intensely sweet, dense. It's one step removed from just sugar pressed into a little ball.
It really, I think, tastes a lot like fudge.
Yeah. In ancient India, would we have been seeing anything fried, anything like a donut? I see like a little, looks like a little fried ball of something here.
It's unclear how far the fried desserts go. There's definitely fried desserts as far back as, oh, let's say, 1,000 years ago. One of the ancient holy liquids was ghee, that is clarified butter. And so how do you make something holier? Well, you fry it in one of the holy substances.
So luckily, if you think sugar and milk and oil are all holy objects.
Yeah, holy donut is it. Yeah.
Yeah, you've pretty much invented the holy donut. Michael Crandall is a food historian and the author of the new book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Thank you so much for going on the quest and eating with me.
It's been an over-the-top delight.
Over-the-top is the correct word there. Thanks. So, while we're on the topic of really old food, let's move from ancient desserts to a finely aged appetizer. In fact, this delicacy has been waiting in a bottle for someone to eat it since 1876. 1876! Just to give you a sense of how old this food item is, it could have been the final snack for George Custer at Little Bighorn. This food could have been noshed on by Alexander Graham Bell as he invented the telephone.
Mr. Watson, come here. I want you.
I have something delicious to eat.
So what is this 135-year-old appetizer? The world's oldest pickle.
It looks like a cucumber, which it is. It looks like a pickle that you can buy in a store in the, like, the bigger ones.
James Boyle of Northport, Florida, owns the historical pickle. And actually, we're not sure it's the oldest. Guinness doesn't exactly keep track of such things.
And it's still got the juice inside of it. It's in an old medicine bottle from back then with the original cork. It's got the brown label on there, and it's written down that it was grown in the bottle July 15th, 1876.
Now, how does a scrumptious pickle last an entire century without someone wanting to relish it? I don't know. I think that joke worked out better in 1876. Well, there is something very special about this old pickle. It was grown inside the bottle. In the bottle. Boyle's great-grandmother in Illinois put a medicine bottle with a narrow neck around a baby cucumber, and it grew in there.
And she had pickled it and corked it, and it has been in the family ever since.
That's how it survived. You couldn't get it out of the bottle to eat it, even if you wanted to. Wait, does anybody actually want to eat it?
No.
Boyle doesn't know the name of his great-grandmother. All he knows is this pickle, passed down, you know, I'd say lovingly, but, well, you should really take a look at the pickle.
You know, a lot of people talk about heirlooms, you know, about jewelry and necklaces and things like that, but why would somebody pass down a pickle? That's just weird, you know, weird or whatever, but, you know, Midwesterners or farmers, and I don't know if that's what they did for fun back then, or we don't know any of that, but it's a fun thing.
And I'm sure his kids are really stoked knowing that someday they too will inherit the family brine.
If they want it, or, you know, it's sitting around, if somebody wants it and the price is right, you know, I'd probably sell it.
Make them an offer after you check out the picture of the pickle on our website, npr.org. In the animated TV show Family Guy, the main character, Peter Griffin, loves to tell raunchy jokes and he loves to sing. That's the voice of Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane. But then again, so is this.
So to a sweet romance, there is just one answer. You and I.
That's from Seth MacFarlane's new album. It's called Music is Better Than Words. And Seth MacFarlane joins us. Actually, Seth, I feel like we need to give you one of those nicknames that the great crooners had. You know, old Blue Eyes is taken. Velvet
Where
Fog is taken.
Going?
What do you want as your nickname?
How about Old Awkward Conversationalist?
Seth, Old Awkward Conversationalist MacFarlane joins us now. Welcome.
It humanizes me. It makes me seem real and just like a regular guy. You know, it's funny. It's worth mentioning. My father listened to All Things Considered throughout my entire childhood. And we have a gag coming up on Family Guy about specifically this. I remember always hearing the coffee during the segment. So, like, you'd see, you know, that was Beethoven's Ninth.
Speaking of elaborate jokes, you know, I'm a big fan of Family Guy. And oftentimes you will go to elaborate lengths to set up a gag. So I have to admit, when I was listening to your new album, I went track after track, and in the back of my head, I kept thinking, the joke's coming, the gag's coming, you know, maybe the 12th, 13th, 14th track, it's coming. And, you know, in the end, of course, it's just romantic.
Yeah, it's almost like you need the reverse of a parental advisory sticker. It's just relaxed, great old music.
You couldn't buy a ticket to hear the first robin sing. It's free because it's anybody's spring.
Well, how did you learn to croon? I mean, croon is this specific thing. It's not just singing a song. There's a certain style to it. How would you describe it, and how did you learn this?
I mean, I've been singing my whole life. I trained professionally when I was younger, and then when I came out to L.A. about 10 years ago, I started training with an extraordinary couple, Lee and Sally Sweetland. And, you know, they trained Streisand. I believe they trained Sinatra at one point. I mean, they were both in their 90s when I hooked up with them. And they just whipped my vocal cords into better shape than they'd ever been in. And that was what really enabled me to do this.
No sweet and pure angelic lass for me. That kind of gal can spin a web, you see.
It's, you know, that combination of ease and diction that they really tried to drill into me.
But it's my independence that she is trading for. The only affirmative she will file refers to marching down the aisle. No golden, glorious, gleaming, pristine goddess. No, sir.
You know, clearly you also have a love of music. How long did it take you before you started to sneak in these big production numbers into something like Family Guy? I mean, was that always the goal, or did you realize that once you were successful, you could do a huge number?
When Family Guy started, we wanted to make it more like a sitcom, and there was very little music. The first musical number I think we did was first season. There was an episode in which the Griffins inherit a mansion, and we did a parody of the I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here song from Annie.
My God, this house is freaking sweet.
And once you hear that, it's kind of addictive. I mean, an orchestra to me is like crack. I mean, it's the greatest thing in the world. And as ridiculous as a lot of these songs were, I wanted them to sound good.
Are you saying I'm ugly?
It doesn't matter, dear. You're rich now.
If a song is funny and absurd and it sounds great, it's just going to be that much funnier. And there's no better example of that than Monty Python. There's a song from Monty Python, The Meaning of Life, called Every Sperm is Sacred.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great.
And it sounds great. The choreography is really good. And it's hysterical that all that work and all that expertise went into something with this content. So with Family Guy, we really embrace that.
So as you're doing these parody songs, is that where you started to get this idea that you would like to, I don't know, do the originals at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I'd always been a fan of this kind of music. My parents exposed me to the Great American Songbook when I was a kid. And from there, I kind of started to explore the 1950s and what it had to offer. And it always looked like, I mean, it sounded exquisite, but it always looked like it was effortless.
That was Laura. But she's only a dream.
I'm speaking with Seth MacFarlane. He has a new CD of big band standards, Music is Better Than Words. Seth, I wanted to ask you quickly about some of your next projects. You are working on a new version of the Flintstones, yes?
Yes, yes.
Why redo the Flintstones?
Well,
and by the way, I heard a little bit of that drinking.
Yeah, look at that. That's
good.
I am on public radio.
So nice.
It was the Marriage of Figaro. it would be so easy and so simple to update the Flintstones, I thought, without really changing that much other than what the stories were about. It couldn't be Fred wants to go bowling with the buddy, you know, with the guys, and so he lies to Wilma because she wants to go to the opera. You know, that kind of antiquated sitcom storytelling would have to be updated in some way.
And of course, you can update all the technology, and you can have iPhone made out of granite, an iStone, right, with a little bird.
Hey, look at that!
Hey, the iStone.
I might use that, man.
You could take that.
The iStone. Holy smokes! I knew it was a good idea to come here.
And there's a little bird inside that says, "It's a living." That was the classic joke.
I'm going to write that down right now, and I'm not ashamed to say it.
Since we have drifted away from music a little bit, is there a good song that you think should end the interview? How do you want to leave people?
You know, Love Won't Let You Get Away is a great tune.
Well, we'll end with that.
Let's kiss, well, here we come again. Carving love's undertow again. Latching on to that glow again. Here we go again, hip hooray.
Still like the sound of your own voice, Seth MacFarlane?
Oh.
Get used to it. There's going to be a lot more of it. Thank you, Seth MacFarlane.
My pleasure.
That's Seth MacFarlane singing Love Won't Let You Get Away with Sarah Bareilles. MacFarlane is the creator of the Fox series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. His debut album, Music is Better Than Words, is just out.
Won't let us get away.
And that is the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. Whether you listen on your iPod or on the radio, our program is directed by Kenya Young and produced by Phil Harrell, with Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, Arthi Shahani, and Jessica Palumbo. Melissa Marquis is our technical director, Rick Holter, our senior editor, and our senior super, it says super, it should be supervising. Our senior supervising producer, he's also super, is Steve Lichtai. I'm Robert Smith. Normally, I host Planet Money. You can also check out that podcast, too, when you're not listening to this one. And you can hear this program, All Things Considered, on your local public radio station in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. We'll be back next week with a brand new podcast. Thank you for listening.